Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Intercepted. Welcome to Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning that famine in the north of Gaza is imminent, and he's called on the international community to immediately facilitate the delivery of aid to the besieged Palestinians. Now, this comes as a major new UN report has issued a dire assessment of the humanitarian situation in the Strip, predicting that within months, more than a million people could face the most severe level of hunger. And the report predicted, quote, alarmingly high acute malnutrition rates among children under five, significant excess mortality, and an imminent risk of starvation. Now, while the Biden administration has in recent weeks become more vocal in public in demanding that Israel facilitate the delivery of more aid, President Biden has refused to use any of the substantial leverage that the U.S. wields over Tel Aviv to back up his public rhetoric. In fact, the White House continues to operate a pipeline of weapons resupplying Israel's forces as they continue the mass killing operations in Gaza. This week, in the early morning hours of Monday, Israeli forces once again laid siege to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, surrounding the complex with tanks and engaging in heavy fire. The Israeli forces then raided the hospital, and they claim they took 80 people prisoner. Palestinian sources say the number is more like 150 people who were snatched during the operations. The IDF claimed that it was conducting what it called a high-precision operation alongside Shin Bet intelligence operatives, but Gaza health officials are saying that anyone who tried to move in the hospital was targeted by sniper bullets and quadcopter attacks. An estimated 30,000 people have taken shelter in the hospital complex and the surrounding area because they believed it to be a protected area. Now, Israel justified this raid by saying that its forces had come under fire from inside the hospital, and Israeli media claimed that the IDF had what they called concrete evidence that Hamas commanders had relocated there from the northern Gaza Strip, and they were using it as a command center to manage their attacks against occupation forces. Al Jazeera reports that an estimated 20 people were killed during this raid. At least one Israeli soldier also died. The overarching official death toll from the past 5+ months in Gaza has now gone over 31,000 people, including 13,000 children. And for all the talk of it being the Hamas-run health ministry's numbers, those numbers are probably very conservative. There are more than 8,000 people who are missing, and many of those are believed to have been trapped or died under the rubble of their former homes or buildings in their communities that were brought down by Israeli attacks. Now, over the past 5+ months, Israel has made a series of unverified claims to justify its attacks and raids against hospitals and other medical facilities in Gaza. Remember, in November, it attacked Al-Shifa, alleging that the hospital was a major Hamas facility and that it was on top of an underground command and control layer, sort of a Hamas Pentagon. Now, those claims were co-signed by the Biden administration, actually more than co-signed. The Biden administration didn't just say, oh, we agree with Israel's assessment. The White House said, we have our own intelligence that indicates that Hamas is using that hospital as a command and control node. Well, when the IDF actually then went in and took control of the hospital and they brought journalists there, they failed to produce any credible evidence to back up these major sweeping claims that they had made about the hospital. Then they moved on to the next raid at the next hospital. As a result of these Israeli attacks, Gaza doesn't have a single fully functioning hospital anymore. Last week, a BBC News investigation documented how medical workers at Nasser Hospital were detained and tortured by Israeli forces following a February 15th raid at that hospital. And among the abuses that medical staff who were detained said that they endured were being stripped naked, being blindfolded and beaten, muzzled dogs being used to menace the prisoners. Some staff reported being doused with cold water and held for hours in stress positions. And as with the Al-Shifa raid that went down this week, the IDF claimed that that raid last month at Nasser Hospital was precise and focused. And there they said they took 200 people captive. They characterized them as terrorists or suspects of terrorist activity, including some who were posing as medical teams. This is part of Israel's constant narrative that basically everyone in Gaza is Hamas, even the UN and doctors, etc. In Brussels on Monday, the EU's top foreign policy official said that there is no longer a question of Gaza being on the brink of famine. He said it is in a state of famine. He said that Israel was using starvation as a weapon of war. The Israelis, of course, pushed back against that. And now with this possible large-scale ground invasion looming over the city of Rafah on the Egypt border, the White House is making it clear that actually they don't have any red lines for Israel, despite the fact that Biden had seemed to indicate that a full-scale invasion of Rafah was a red line. The White House saying now, no, Israel will make its own decisions. Instead, the White House is inviting an Israeli team to come and discuss a way to do a, you know, sort of lighter version of a targeted operation in Rafah. To discuss all of these developments, as well as the fate of Marwan Barghouti, the Palestinian resistance figure who is serving multiple life sentences in an Israeli prison. There were reports this week that he has been beaten in prison. Some have said that he is akin to the Nelson Mandela of the Palestinian liberation cause. We go to Haifa, and we're joined by the human rights lawyer and political analyst, Diana Boutu. Diana, thank you so much for being with us here on Intercepted.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It's nice to be with you.
I want to begin by some of the most recent developments that we've seen. The World Food Program is now saying that there will be all-out starvation setting in Gaza between now and May. Some people say in parts of Gaza, that's already the reality. On Monday, the top EU foreign policy official, Josep Borrell, accused Israel of deliberately imposing a policy of starvation on Gaza. And then we had yet another raid on Al-Shifa Hospital by Israeli forces where dozens of people were detained. Talk about these latest events and what you think this says about where things are headed as Ramadan continues.
This is genocide. And we've known this from the first day that Israel was intending to carry out genocide. It's important to keep in mind that from day one, the Israeli Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, said that there would be no food, no water, no electricity, no fuel. And alongside that, they also mean no medicine. And that what they were dealing with is human animals. These were his words. And so it's not at all surprising that now, as we're approaching nearly 6 months in, that we've seen starvation deaths in the north, where most of the people who are dying are the most vulnerable, children, and in some cases, the elderly, who are also suffering from diseases. So it's not at all surprising that we are seeing this, and it's not at all surprising that we see the world's inaction when it comes to everything from Israel's attack on hospitals, to the attack on schools, to the attack on cultural centers, to the to every form of Palestinian life. Because what the message is that Israel is sending to Palestinians is, if you want to have a normal life, it's going to be outside of Gaza. If you want to get food, outside of Gaza. If you want to get medical treatment, outside of Gaza. You want to go to school, outside of Gaza. Do you want to have any cultural preservation, outside of Gaza? And this is what Israel has said that they are doing. And this is what they're doing. This is what they're doing. The sad part is that Israel's made it so clear, and yet nobody's doing anything to stop Israel. Quite the opposite. They're providing excuse after excuse for Israel to continue this genocide.
You know, the Biden administration, for these past 5.5 months of sustained scorched earth attacks by the Israelis, has continued the flow of weapons to Israel, has continued the political support for Israel, has prevented other nations of the world from demanding an immediate ceasefire using the veto power at the United Nations. And the past couple of months, we've seen this shift in some of the overt public rhetoric, you know, stories of Biden growing impatient with his great-great friend Bibi Netanyahu, and then you add Kamala Harris, the American vice president, starting to use the word ceasefire. And now Joe Biden, as he stood with the leader of Ireland on St. Patrick's Day, saying, oh, we share common ground with Ireland. We need to get a ceasefire implemented as soon as possible. But the U.S. is very, very clear. There is no actual red line regarding Rafah. You know, no one should read too deeply into the fact that the president actually said there was, that no, the U.S. remains committed to providing Israel with weapons that Washington characterizes as being used in self-defense. And, you know, the Democrats appear now to put the full blame on Netanyahu, asserting that Biden has done whatever he could to rein him in. You know, you have Chuck Schumer, a very open, public Zionist, a passionate supporter of Israel through all of its most horrifying policies. He's now saying, oh, well, the Israelis need to choose a new leader. You know, Netanyahu has to go. How are you reading this refinement of the narrative coming out of the centers of power in Washington, D.C.?
This is the kind of stuff that they talk about in the Belt, but it's not the stuff that actually changes policy for Palestinians. But more importantly, it's important to note that this isn't just Netanyahu. We've seen for the past 5.5 months, video after video of soldier after soldier carrying out war crimes and proudly doing so. Those soldiers are not Netanyahu. Those soldiers are part of the Israeli society. And inside Israeli society today, you see an appetite. You see that there is nobody willing to stop this genocide. To the contrary, they make fun of Palestinians for the fact that there is no water. They've made fun of Palestinians for not having food. They've made fun of Palestinians for not having medicine. Most recently, they made fun of Palestinians who were killed as these food baskets were being dropped from the sky, and they were poking fun at Palestinians. So this isn't just one individual. This is Israel. This is Israeli society. And the reason that it is like this is because for all of these years, for 75 years, nobody has reined in Israeli leaders. It's been to the contrary. We get these little hints that they're not happy. But what the U.S. is effectively saying now is that it has no leverage over Israel. That's the message that they're saying to Palestinians. We have no leverage over Netanyahu. And as much as people are saying that this is some row or some showdown, the person who's going to come out on top is going to be Benjamin Netanyahu, because he knows that it can do whatever it wants, and he knows that Biden is not going to do a thing to stop him.
That is true, of course. At the same time, the White House pretends that it has no leverage over Netanyahu, but actually there were media reports over the weekend, including from ABC News, that indicate that the Israelis are telling the White House that they're short on tank munitions, even with one senior Israeli official saying, you know, oh, this could mean that we don't end up winning the war, and they're accusing Washington of slow walking some of the recent weapons shipments. The U.S. was quick to come forward and say, we haven't done that yet. But anyone who knows history knows that Joe Biden, even just recent history under Biden, in 2021, Biden was able to bring the intense siege against Gaza to a very swift halt with a phone call to Netanyahu. He basically said that you have no more runway, this is done. And within 48 hours, Netanyahu was in talks with the Egyptian regime, and the thing was brought to a close. So it's a ridiculous notion to imply that the U.S. has no leverage. The question becomes why Biden won't use any of that leverage. And, you know, there's one school of thought that, you know, Biden has been the most tenacious defender of Israel when it's at its most violent throughout the course of his half century in politics. But then there's another part of this, which is that Israel has a tremendous amount of influence in U.S. politics. AIPAC inside of the United States pours money into the campaign coffers of politicians or into efforts to try to defeat politicians that it believes are not sufficiently, quote unquote, pro-Israel enough. So I want to ask you, because you're a lawyer, because you've worked on these human rights issues, and because you follow the politics, what is behind the U.S. policy? What is driving this right now?
It's hard to say. I agree with you. I do think that Biden has leverage. But the message that he's sending is that he doesn't have leverage. And so the question becomes, as you put it, why isn't he using that leverage? I think in part is that he has taken the position that every other American leader has taken, which is to kick it down the can to the next presidency. And he has never really wanted to confront Israel, to deal with Israel, because at this point in time, this isn't just the question of a phone call. It's going to be a question of a phone call followed by some action. For Netanyahu, this is an end of career move. We know that the minute that Israel's attack on Gaza is over, the minute after that, Netanyahu is going to be out of office. Why? The Israeli public does not like him, whether you're on the left wing or you're on the right wing, what's left of the left wing, or you're on the right wing. All of them are blaming Netanyahu. And the only reasons that he's prolonging this is, first, because he can. And second, because he knows that by ending this, it'll be the end of his political career. If you're on the right, you are blaming Netanyahu for not hitting Palestinians enough over the course of his term in office. And if you're on the so-called left, you're blaming Netanyahu for not keeping Israelis, quote unquote, safe while an occupation rages on. So when it comes to Biden, I think that he's just wanted to take this position of kicking it down to the next presidency, to the next term, to the next term. And unfortunately, to pick up the phone and to force Netanyahu to stop means more than just picking up the phone. It actually means some concrete action. And I just don't think he's willing to go there.
I want to ask you about the political dynamics in Gaza prior to October 7th and what maybe we can expect going forward. There are some reports in the Israeli media that in this current round of negotiations between David Barnea, the head of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, and other mediators, that Hamas is going to put forward Yahya Sinwar as the direct negotiator. Now, these are not confirmed reports, but it wouldn't be necessarily surprising. I mean, Sinwar was a couple of decades in Israeli prisons. He speaks fluent Hebrew. But it does seem that there is a lot more discussion right now about who may govern a future Gaza, if there are, in fact, Palestinians left in Gaza after the Israelis are done with this campaign, this massive attack on the on civilian life and institutions in Gaza. But my sense is that Hamas did not have extreme popularity in Gaza prior to this. But even among many factions that are critical of Hamas or anti-Hamas, that there does seem to be a broad consensus that Hamas needs to be part of any future discussions on the existence of Gaza and how it would govern. Walk us through sort of your understanding of what things were like politically in Gaza prior to October 7th and how the tapestry of organizations across occupied Palestine view Hamas going forward.
Let me preface this by talking about what it means to rule over Gaza or to rule over the West Bank. And I'm using that term in air quotes. And the reason I'm using air quotes is because there's no such thing as ruling over it. What I mean by this is that the West Bank is not a sovereign state. Neither is the Gaza Strip. Everything is linked to Israel. And there isn't a separate currency. There isn't a separate economic system. I used to joke around and say that the Palestinian Authority Minister of Transportation has probably as much authority over the transportation system as a child does over their little train that they have. And that's it. It's a system in which this is a government that is the subcontractor to Israel. In some cases in the West Bank, it's the security subcontractor to Israel. But in the case of the Gaza Strip, it's not necessarily the security subcontractor, but a subcontractor nonetheless. And it's because Gaza is not an independent state, because the West Bank is not an independent state, because Palestine is not free. And so because these entities are not free, they operate effectively with their hands tied behind their backs, and they can't really do much. So if you look at a normal government or places around the world, what is it that citizens want from a government? They want to have some sort of economic policy, some healthcare policy, some education policy. They want to have some policies when it comes to retirement. And of course, people want to be free. None of this can be delivered by any shape of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank or by Hamas in the Gaza Strip because of the control that is exerted by Israel, and because of not only the control that's exerted by Israel, but by the conditions that are placed on Palestinians and by these authorities, by the international community. And so as a result, if you look at public opinion polling in the West Bank on October the 6th, Fatah was, which is the ruling party in the West Bank, Fatah was at a low. Not only was Fatah at a low, but the president himself, we had about somewhere in the, I think it's 80% of Palestinians said that he should resign. I mean, this isn't, please don't run in the next election. It is resign. We're not happy with you. The same idea was present in Gaza, not with the same numbers, but again, a lot of discontent. And you have to ask why. And it's because they don't have the ability to properly lead, to properly function, to properly govern, because it's not a state. So that was the state of affairs in the Gaza Strip. Hamas was not entirely popular on October the 6th for the reasons I mentioned. And in the West Bank, Fatah was not popular on October the 6th for the reasons I mentioned. Today, I can't really speak to Gaza because I'm not there, but I can speak to the West Bank. Today, support for Hamas has risen a lot. Why? Because people see that the only political movement that's standing between them, between us as Palestinians, and Israel's extermination of us is Hamas. That there is a political body that is resisting and that isn't just going to lay down and allow Israel to walk all over us. The question becomes, what does it mean for the future? And here's where it becomes very important for Palestinians to be able to decide their own future. I've heard time and again from Israeli leader after Israeli leader, from international leader after international leader, saying that there's no future for Hamas in Gaza. I'm sorry, it's not for them to decide. This is entirely for Palestinians to decide. And it may be that Hamas decides that they don't want to be in the political side of things any longer. I don't know. But whatever decision is taken has to be a Palestinian one. And this idea of pandering to what the West wants, that has got to come to an end. You know, Jeremy, I want to share just an anecdote with you, if I may, of something that happened in 2005 when I was part of the team that was involved in the Israeli disengagement. So in 2005, Israel pulled out of the settlements from the Gaza Strip, and it pulled out all of the settlers as well. But it didn't end the occupation. Okay, so it took down the settlements for sure. And the settlers left, but it didn't end its control over the Gaza Strip. And at that time in 2005, there was a lot of fanfare, and Israel was rewarded quite handsomely for doing this withdrawal, this disengagement from the Gaza Strip. At the time, the members of the international community kept asking the Palestinian team, I was part of it, what is needed to make the Gaza Strip viable? And actually, President Bush had even asked this question. And the answer was simple. Allow Palestinians to live freely. An airport, a seaport, a connection to the West Bank, a connection to the world, to be able to control our own economy and our own future. Now, at the time, the Israelis said, no, we can't do that because they're obsessed with control. They're obsessed with this idea of constantly controlling Palestinian lives. And so in the process of discussing things, the Israelis insisted that for goods to be able to get in and out of the Gaza Strip, that they needed to be scanned. And I'll never forget the conversation that I had with somebody from the Israeli side who indicated to me the following. He said, yes, goods need to be scanned going in and goods that are coming out need to be scanned. And the level of scanner that we require is so high that it actually doesn't exist. You hear this and you should like scoff or say, this is absolutely absurd. And yet, when we told this to the international, like the heads of international organizations, to heads of state, their response was, oh, but you need to work with Israel. You need to appease Israel. And I'm telling you this anecdote because those days of appeasing Israel have got to come to an end. And had they actually listened to Palestinians back in 2005, I don't think we'd be in this place today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I wanted to ask you also about Marwan Barghouti. We recently were interviewing Dr. Mustafa Barghouti and asked him a bit about, you know, his potential future aspirations, but also he was describing the importance of Marwan Barghouti to the broader Palestinian liberation cause. And of course, for people that aren't familiar, Marwan Barghouti has spent 2 decades in prison in Israel. He's sentenced to multiple life sentences. In a broader kind of mainstream sense, he's been compared on some levels to a Nelson Mandela type figure for Palestinians. But I think there's a broad consensus that he would be one of the figures that could successfully preside over a free and independent Palestine. And Hamas has said that Barghouti is not a member of Hamas, but Hamas has said that they are prioritizing his liberation in negotiations with the Israeli government. Talk a bit about Marwan Barghouti, your knowledge of his background, his importance, and whether you think that is an apt comparison to say that he is a Mandela-like figure in the context of contemporary Palestinian resistance politics.
He is very much a Nelson Mandela-like figure, but there's a big difference between the two. And the big difference is that the ANC, at every opportunity, was making sure to put forward Nelson Mandela's name. In our case, we have a Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, who has spent the past 19 years in office never really uttering his name or pushing for Marwan's freedom. And the reason that he doesn't do that is because he sees him as a rival. So who is Marwan Barghouti? Marwan Barghouti was a leader of the second Palestinian uprising, the Intifada. He's a member of Fatah. He's a member of Fatah in the grassroots sense. He's an activist who has worked in a number of different communities. But not only did he work in a number of different communities, he was also imprisoned by Israel a number of times, speaks Hebrew. And at the start of Oslo, like many others, he very much believed in this idea that there could be a two-state settlement, that there could be a Palestinian state. And he actually went to the Knesset, spoke before the Knesset, and talked to them about this idea of having a Palestinian state. But he also recognizes that the issue of negotiations is only going to get Palestinians so far. And very early on during the Second Intifada, he came out and said, this process of negotiations is a sham. We've got nothing out of it except increased settlements. And he very much believed in, and continues to believe in, garnering power and garnering political support and in trying to create an opposition to the Israeli occupation. And this is primarily why he's been thrown in prison. The Israelis didn't like the fact that he was involved with the Fatah organizations that were involved during the Second Intifada, and instead arrested him and threw him in jail. And he's now serving, I don't even know how many life sentences that he's serving without ever the possibility of ever being released. Can he be a uniting figure? Yes. What's so fascinating is that people still talk about him, even though he's been in prison now since 2002. That's 22 years in April, 22 years that he's been in prison. And yet, as I mentioned, we've had a Palestinian leadership that hasn't even uttered his name over the course of the past 19 years. So yes, he does have that ability to be a leader, to unite people. But ultimately, it remains up to Palestinians to decide. I think the bigger issue is that we must be pushing for his release, as we must be pushing for the release of all Palestinian political prisoners, because there is no way for us to build, to move forward, without having these individuals in our midst.
I want to ask you about the situation. You referenced other prisoners, the situation in the West Bank. I mean, it often doesn't get as much attention as the horrifying realities occurring in Gaza, but there has been an intense Israeli campaign that has multiple prongs. On the one hand, you have Israeli state-backed and armed settlers that are going in and snatching Palestinians' homes by force, and some Palestinians have been killed in those operations, and many have been displaced. But you also have had the official Israeli forces going in and rounding up thousands of people that they're taking into custody as political prisoners. And some of them are being disappeared into the military justice system. Others are being held in administrative limbo, where they are denied the most basic fundamental rights of prisoners around the world. And there are minors, there are children that are continuing to be snatched by Israel and held in conditions where they are denied access to their families, where they are certainly initially denied any access to lawyers, and then they're being prosecuted and held in a military court system. But describe, because you work on these cases as well, Diana, describe what people may not be familiar with of the intensity of the situation right now in the West Bank, what Palestinians are facing right now.
Right now? Actually, even before. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find one Palestinian family that didn't have either a family member or a friend who has been inside an Israeli prison. If you look at the statistics, I believe the number is something like 20% of all Palestinians have been incarcerated. All Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza, let me be clear, which means probably 40% of all Palestinian men have been thrown into an Israeli prison. What's happened since October the 7th has been even worse. There's a few things that have happened. The first is that in addition to the usual violence of abducting people in the middle of the night, the campaign has been now increasing against children. And we've seen more and more children being abducted in the middle of the night since October the 7th, thrown into prison, and many of them thrown into prison, again, without charge or without trial. What's important to note when it comes to children is because the rules differ when it comes to Palestinian children versus Israeli children, the system is designed to extract a confession or to extract a guilty plea from you. Because if you plead guilty to a charge, then you end up going to prison for less time than you do if you actually simply await trial. that's the way that the system has been rigged, is that they've dragged it out in such a way that children can be thrown in prison without charge, without trial. Eventually, if they do get charged with something, that they are held in prison pending trial for quite a long period of time. And if you're the parent of one of these children and you're faced with a plea, then you're more likely going to urge your child to accept a plea, even though they haven't done anything, just in order to be able to secure their release. But since October the 7th, not only has that increased, but the conditions inside the prisons have become that much worse. Of all of the children who were released during the first ceasefire back in November, each and every one of them, and I interviewed a large number of them, had indicated that they were beaten. Some of them were tortured. All of them were denied adequate food. They were put, in some cases, 10 young boys in one cell. They were given enough food for three, and they were only given food once or twice a day. They were only allowed to take a bath once or twice a week. And in addition to being thrown into the cells with so many people, overcrowding, they were often beaten for everything from asking for water, asking for to be able to take a shower, asking for food, asking to be able to see a lawyer, asking to be able to see their family. These are children that we're talking about. The same is true when it has come to women who are being held in Israeli prisons as well. Many of the women who have been released have talked about the violence and often sexual violence that has been meted out against them. Many of them talked about torture. And again, the same system of not giving them access to food, no access to water, no access to their lawyers, no access to families. Currently, there are approximately 9,077 Palestinians who are being held in Israeli prisons, including some 700 children. And it's about two-thirds, around 6,200, who have not been charged with a crime. And that means in that system of administrative detention. And there's really no way to challenge the system. Because the Israelis are in the throes of giving the state carte blanche, this is why we don't even see proper reporting about the conditions under which people are being held. We don't see that the judges are demanding that children have access to legal representation, that they have access to their families. Everything has been swept under the rug. But it's not just that. In some cases, the detentions are sometimes 2 and 3 and 4 days where we don't even know where the individual is held. And I've met with some political prisoners who have told me that they had everything from dogs attacking them and mauling them to being forced to crawl around on all fours and call the prison guard their master, to denounce Hamas, to denounce any Palestinian leadership. I've heard from prisoners where they've said that they were held and forced to stand around for days without any clothing on, with their hands shackled high up in the air. And again, any complaints, even one of them said that whenever he complained about how tight the shackles were on his hands and on his legs, that he was then beaten as well. It's very violent. It's very violent. And the Red Cross has been denied access to these prisons. So we really don't know what is happening in these prisons at this point in time.
I want to ask you about another line that obviously Netanyahu and people from his side of the spectrum in Israel promote this notion that there should be one state, the state of Israel, and that Arabs and Palestinians who live in Israel and have accepted Israeli citizenship and society, that they're able to live really fruitful and productive and peaceful lives. I'm speaking to you right now. You're in Haifa. I'm wondering your analysis of that portrayal that if Palestinians would just accept coexistence under the Israeli state, that life would actually be fine and tranquil and give them the best chance at living a fruitful, positive existence.
The problem, of course, is that that's not the reality. So 20% of Israel's population is Palestinian. And that 20% are those who did not flee in 1948 and their descendants. So in 1948, about 150,000 Palestinians remained in Palestine. And that number is now close to 2 million. The problem, of course, is that we still live in the aftermath of the Nakba. And there has never been either a reckoning of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, nor has there been an attempt to do anything other than to erect a system of Jewish supremacy and Jewish superiority. So what Israel is effectively saying is, if you accept your status as a defeated, second-class, inferior citizen who is not entitled to the same rights as everybody else, even though you're in your homeland, then, you know, you'll be okay. But the problem is that they're never really willing to challenge this idea of Jewish supremacy. And so what does it look like? First is that there are laws that are on the books that either directly or indirectly discriminate against Palestinians who hold Israeli citizenship. There's about 60 of them. There's more if you take into account some of the other regulations. And these laws affect practically every aspect of your life. So, for example, there is a law that says that communities that are of a certain size have the ability to determine whether somebody who wants to move into that community, whether they're considered suitable for the community. Now, that should be sending alarm bells ringing for people. But in the Israeli system, not only is it normal, but it's been upheld as being legit by the Israeli Supreme Court. If you try to raise anything in relation to the Nakba, and you know, the Nakba wasn't that long ago, 75 years ago, it's immediately shot down. If you try to demand equal rights, and there have been attempts to push forward bills in the Knesset to demand that Israel be a state of its citizens, that has also been struck down. So there's nothing in this system that ever allows you to be a full equal. It's always going to be a system that's based on Jewish supremacy, Jewish superiority, and never one of equality. And this became much more apparent in the aftermath of October the 7th. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. So one was, there was a Palestinian singer who on October the 7th posted in Arabic on Facebook, "La ghalib illallah, there is no victor but God." And she used a little Palestinian flag emoji. She was thrown in prison for that post. And then after being released from prison, for every day since she's been released from prison, since the end of October until the current day, there's been a campaign of demanding her expulsion from her city, a campaign to demand that her husband, who's a doctor and the deputy director of a hospital, that he be expelled from his job. Now, I want you to contrast that with the most popular song that exists now inside Israel. It's a song that openly calls for genocide, which has had 20 million views on YouTube alone. The top five songs in the country are songs that call for genocide. We openly hear Israeli leaders talking about genocide. We see people, ordinary people, post about this day in and day out, and yet nothing happens to them.
Picking up on that question then, what do you see as a viable and just resolution to the entire situation? I mean, obviously it seems that Joe Biden and European officials are now trying to talk up two-state solution. There are others who say there should be a one-state solution, and that state is Palestine. And then, of course, the Israeli government position, certainly under Netanyahu, but probably under other governments as well, is that there isn't going to be a Palestinian state, and the world's just going to have to accept that. But given your decades working on this issue as a lawyer, as a spokesperson for the PLO, as an activist, an advocate, what, in your personal view, is the most just resolution that could come about after the Nakba, after these 75 years of constant attacks against Palestinian people, after the events of October 7th and the subsequent genocidal war by Israel? What does a just future look like?
First, I think it's important for us to focus on ending the genocide first. It's hard to talk about the aftermath without understanding what it is that we're going through right now. And I don't want any like sort of future or idea to be only thought of based on what we're presently going through. That's what happened with Oslo in the first place. But I want to step back and look at like the bigger picture in terms of where things are. I want to contrast and compare a few things. So if you look at apartheid South Africa and the end of apartheid South Africa, that was a very important moment in history. But because apartheid ended in South Africa in the way that it ended without ever really addressing the root causes of it, we see that today that South Africa is still one of these places where there's such an unjust distribution of resources. And looking at Palestine, I think that we have to start thinking in terms of decolonization. Now, it's, I know, a big word, whatever, but the idea is that I don't think we should be basing our vision of the future based on the current reality. Just 75 years ago, Israel destroyed, depopulated more than 500 villages. Those descendants are still alive. Those people are still alive. Much of that land has not been used. It's possible for us to really be thinking of a future that is much more visionary, much more inclusive, and not one that is confined to this idea of, is it going to be two state? Is it going to be one state? Right now, I think much of this talk of solutions is a way of trying to absolve the world of stopping this genocide. Like, let's just talk about a two-state solution, because then we don't have to really focus on holding Israel accountable for committing genocide. And I think that we have to think much bigger and much broader than that. And when I think about bigger and broader than that, I do think that we have to recognize that the Nakba happened not very long ago, that there has to be a process of decolonizing the place, that Palestinians must be given their rights, that Palestinians do have the right to return, and that anybody who wants to see this place prosper should be demanding that Palestinians be able to return. This is your capital. This is where your investment is. And instead, I think that there isn't really a future any longer for Zionism. And I think that the Israelis have to soon come to this realization. They've been given the message that they can build a state on the ruins of another country, that they can continue to, as the British had done, beat the natives over the head and hope that they will somehow beat them into submission. I think they have to now recognize that that's just not going to be a formula for future prosperity. And instead, we have to think about going to a place where Palestinians are given their proper rights, no longer as secondary or as second-class citizens or under this carpet of Jewish supremacy.
On that note, though, I wanted to ask you about public opinion in Israel about the war in Gaza. The most recent public opinion polls that were taken were in late January and found that a large majority of the Jewish public thinks that the IDF is using adequate or too little force in Gaza, and an absolute majority of the Jewish public in Israel, 88%, believes that the scope of casualties suffered among Palestinians in Gaza are justified.
Yes.
You know, a lot of my Palestinian friends say, how do you coexist with a population that holds those opinions? And, you know, I mean, it's Israel often, well, we have a right to exist. We have a right to self-defense. And then you have the White House sort of now saying, well, this is a Netanyahu extremist thing. But I think the reality is that you have a very solid majority of the Jewish Israeli public that believes this is perfectly acceptable to do to the people of Gaza.
Absolutely. That's the part that's so terrifying, is that when we talk about genocide, this isn't just one statement coming from one individual. It's not just one soldier that's in Gaza. This is an entire system that is taking their orders from the top down. We've heard the president say that there are no innocents in Gaza. We've heard the prime minister refer to this as the children of light versus the children of darkness. We've heard the minister of defense. I mean, it just goes down and down and down. If you turn on the TV on any given day, you'll hear one Israeli commentator after another saying things like, we need to get rid of them. There should have been 100,000 dead at this point in time. And you can see as you drive throughout the country, signs that read, finish them. Signs that read, together we will succeed. And when I probe people and ask them, what does that mean? What does together mean? What does succeed mean? They have no way of defining it, except to say that the more destroyed that Gaza is, the better it is. Because they've been, again, fed this line that if you just beat Palestinians more and beat them more and beat them more and beat them even more, that somehow they will submit, that somehow they will become subservient and obedient. And they haven't quite figured that out yet. This is why I say that when going through this idea of de-Zionizing this place, they have to be made aware that what Israel's doing is not normal, that this is not the actions of a normal state. Just in the same way that you see now the aftermath in countries around the world that carried out genocides, that they have an education process. That education process has never happened in Israel. The only education process that they have been fed is that Palestinians are deserving of more and more and more violence meted out by the Israelis. And that is something that really must be addressed.
Diana, thank you so much for taking time with us during Ramadan to have this conversation. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That was Diana Boutu, a Palestinian human rights attorney and political analyst. And that does it for this episode of Intercepted. Intercepted is a production of The Intercept. Laura Flynn produced this episode. Rick Kwan mixed our show. Legal review was done by Sean Musgrave and Elizabeth Sanchez. This episode was transcribed by Leonardo Fireman. Our theme music, as always, was composed by DJ Spooky. If you want to support our work, you can go to theintercept.com/join. Your donation, no matter the size, makes a real difference. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Intercepted and check out our other podcast hosted by my colleague Ryan Grimm. It's called Deconstructed. Also, leave us a rating and a review wherever you find our podcasts. It helps other people to find us as well. If you want to give us feedback, you can email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.